Elm Coffee Roasters, open in Pioneer Square and SLE for takeout, and soon indoor seating. Order coffee and more at elmcoffeeroasters.com.
Welcome to How Do I Get Your Job, a podcast by the UW Daily. This is a podcast where we're going to be talking to professionals about their jobs, and you guessed it, how they got them. I'm Kate Connors. Today we're talking to Dr. Mark Rogers. Dr. Rogers is a lecturer at the University of Washington, currently affiliated with the Music History Department in the School of Music. Dr. Rogers teaches core music history classes here at UW, as well as an interdisciplinary course about birdsong. He also organizes the oral history project Musical Works in the Time of COVID-19, which includes interviews conducted by students in his music and labor course at the UW School of Music. First, thank you so much for being here. And to start us off, I'll have you introduce yourself. Tell us a bit about who you are, where you're from, and what work you're doing right now.
Thanks, Kate. So, thank you for that wonderful introduction. I'll start at the beginning, I guess. I was an undergraduate at the University of California, Berkeley, where I majored in music and comparative literature. I didn't start out thinking I was going to major in those things, so perhaps that's something that we can talk about at some point, but that's where I ended up. And after my time at Berkeley, or rather in the middle of my time at Berkeley, actually, I spent a year studying abroad at the University of Oxford, at the Queen's College in Oxford. And I really enjoyed that experience, and I wanted to go back, and I wasn't ready when I finished at Berkeley to dive straight into a PhD program. So I spent another year in Oxford pursuing a master's degree. So I went back and did a master's degree in music history. And after that, I went to Yale in New Haven, Connecticut, where I completed my PhD. And my doctoral work was about the history of tonality, which is a kind of important concept in music theory and in music history as well. And Italian Renaissance songs, so songs in Italian from the 16th century, in my case, and cultural theory, the theory of what culture is and how it changes over time and how it spreads and how it affects how people behave, in my case, how they behave musically. And I finished my dissertation in late 2018, and while I was finishing that, in fall of 2018, I started teaching at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, and I taught there for a year. And then in 2019, my wife actually got a job teaching in cinema and media studies here at the University of Washington. We sent them my CV, and the School of Music liked it enough. Like, I guess they liked what they saw, so they offered me a position as well, teaching in the music history department. So that's how I got here, I guess, in 2019. We moved out here, and I've been teaching at the School of Music ever since.
That's so amazing, and your story is really complex, and I really enjoy it. We're going to definitely come back to being an undecided major at Berkeley a little bit later in the podcast. But if you could talk us through why you chose to teach music history, and also your interdisciplinary course about birdsong here at the University of Washington. And for some of our listeners who may not have much experience with those topics, could you tell us what they are as well?
Yeah, sure. So music history, I guess I'll start there since that's probably what I spend more of my time in general teaching and thinking about. So music history is, as the name suggests, it's the study of the history of music conceived very broadly. So you can study anything from ancient Mesopotamian music to, you know, contemporary hip hop or pop music or what have you. There's also a kind of adjacent discipline called ethnomusicology, which is the study of kind of music situated in cultures. And historically, that's mostly focused on cultures from around the world. Today, that couldn't be. I have a close friend who's an ethnomusicologist who studies hip hop. His work is also sort of historical. So increasingly, the lines between those two disciplines that can be kind of blurry. But so music historians kind of study how music has changed over time. We study what music was like in the past at various points, or what it's like in the present kind of placing music in the present in some kind of historical context. There are lots of different ways to do this. Some people focus more on the historical context. Some people focus more on the music as sound, as it were. For my part, I try to kind of negotiate between those two things, think both about context and about sound. And thinking about sound beyond music as well sort of steered me in the direction of a field that's often called sound studies. And I don't exactly work in sound studies, but some of the thinking that I do about birdsong might fall under that category, the category of sound studies. It's an open question, and it's a question we actually ask in my birdsong class, whether birdsong is music. And if it's not music, then surely it's some kind of sound, right? I think it's like music, whether or not it is music, and whether or not that question is ultimately useful is also, I think, an open question. I think there are more interesting questions that we can ask ultimately, but asking that question in that course leads to a lot of interesting conversations. So I also got interested in birdsong because I'm an enthusiastic but very amateur birder myself. So I like to go out and look at and listen to birds in their natural environments. And so teaching this birdsong course, which I offered last year through the Interdisciplinary Honors Program, was a way of kind of combining my professional and personal interests, and got to spend a lot of time outside in connection with that class. And yeah, it was really fun. So it was a nice addition to the teaching that I already do in the School of Music.
That is so fun. I love hearing about people being able to pursue their hobbies as in their jobs as well. Especially with you being an amateur birder, I find that so cool. The only birds that I have really seen around the UW are pigeons at the moment. So I don't have as much experience with birding, but
I think you'll see crows if you keep looking.
Oh, that's true. Yeah. If you look around like the ivy, you'll definitely see some crows. I read that you also teach Music 185, or the concert season, basically every quarter. Seeing as how it's based around live performances and talking to performers around the UW campus, and next to nothing was happening in person last year, and we're only just starting to perform live again, how did you manage to change that course to work with and around COVID?
Yeah, thanks for asking. It was really tricky, as you might imagine. So I'll back up a step and tell you a little bit more about the class in general, if that's okay. So there's a kind of genre of class that most music departments and most schools of music offer at universities called music appreciation, which is essentially a kind of quick and dirty introduction to all of music history. No, not all of it, not actually all of it, right? But kind of the history, generally speaking, the history of what we usually referred to as classical music. So this is a course that's a little bit like that, but instead of having a history textbook, right, and spending a lot of time studying examples but never actually seeing them performed, this class introduces students, at least as I offer it, this course introduces students to what I call the concert hall traditions of classical music and jazz through live performance. So because there was very little in the way of in-person live performance happening in late 2020 and 2021, last year, in other words, when I was offering this course kind of at the height of the pandemic, not to say that we've left the pandemic, we're still in the midst of the pandemic, right? But certainly when case counts were extremely high all around the country, it was a challenge to kind of come up with ways of rethinking what this course that's all about going to concerts in person could be. So I knew from the work that I was doing in my music and labor course with the oral history project that you mentioned before, I knew that a lot of local ensembles were working really hard to continue to produce concerts in one way or another that people could watch remotely. And I also knew that local arts organizations were really kind of struggling to stay afloat, and that it was important to try to cultivate the potential audiences for those groups when it became safe again to go to concerts in person. So the way I reorganized the course essentially was to make it a little bit more like a conventional music appreciation class, insofar as I offer students a really an even more cursory introduction to the history of music from, say, the late Renaissance around 1600 through the present. a really cursory introduction, things to listen for when they go to concerts, and then each week to focus on a different local arts organization, usually a musical ensemble of some kind or one of the ensembles at the School of Music, focus on what they were doing and showcase one of the generally streaming, sometimes recorded concerts that they were offering. And I was able to offer most of this material to students for free, which was really exciting to me, especially because these groups were struggling financially. So it was really generous of them in many cases to make this content available to students. This included groups like Seattle Opera, right? Which normally those tickets, student tickets are $25, but you can spend as much as $250 on those tickets ordinarily. So it's a really good deal for students, I think. And I got to work closely with some of these organizations, brought some of their musicians, some of their artistic leadership in to have conversations kind of like this one. So there's a sort of podcast style element to that course as well. And then the students just watch kind of weekly lectures where I, try to provide some historical context for the music in the concerts that they were streaming, that they are streaming. I'm offering the course again this year. And it was a challenge, but it was a really interesting challenge. It gave me the opportunity to, without actually being the administrator of something like the Seattle Symphony or Seattle Opera, to put together a season of different concerts, kind of curate. So there's a sort of curatorial role there for me that's actually really enjoyable. Got to talk to lots of musicians about the work that they do. And, for someone, I just arrived on the scene in 2019, right? And I spent the last 10 years living in England and then on the East Coast. So I didn't know anyone really in Seattle and in the local music scene. So organizing this course has also been really great for me as somebody who's new to music in Seattle, just to, I also get a sense of what's going on here in this course along with the students. And I've gotten to meet a lot of musicians, a lot of really interesting people. And it gives me a lot of pleasure to showcase for the students and for the musicians as well, just how much extraordinary musicianship there is in this very musical city. But most people associate us with, grunge or, like the Seattle sound, right, from the early 90s or indie pop from the early 2000s, like Death Cab for Cutie and stuff like that. So, it's been a lot of fun. I've learned a lot teaching that course. And I still get messages from students sometimes who are sharing examples of things that they've come across in their own listening and drawing connections with things they heard in the course. So that's been a very rewarding experience, I would say.
That is absolutely amazing. It's so great, especially for professors to hear back from former students about what they thought about the class and things that they can connect to. I always love, as a student, to send messages to professors and be like, thank you so much. I actually heard like such and such today say something about this that reminded me of your course. I always find that super fun.
Open since 2015, Elm Coffee Roasters is devoted to high quality coffee that's easy to brew at home and a joy to drink. At our roastery and cafe in Pioneer Square, Seattle, Elm obsessively roasts small batches of coffee that they source with a focus on sustainable practices that lift up the whole supply chain and protect the future of the coffee plant. Elm's goal is to make a truly exceptional cup of coffee and experience that you will look forward to every day. The cafes in Pioneer Square and SLU are open now for takeout and soon dine-in service. Please use code PODCAST at elmcoffeeroasters.com for 15% off your next coffee order.
You mentioned, and we mentioned in your intro as well, that you are working on an oral history project called Musical Work in the Time of COVID-19. You really picked an interesting time to come to Washington and, anywhere in the United States during 2019, which was right before the start of COVID. And so has your teaching experience been different? Have you learned anything from being here during the time of COVID-19 in, say, your time at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, where you were there prior to the start of COVID? Has that been different for you in any way?
Yeah, it has been different. And so the oral history project is connected with a course that I teach, as you mentioned before in the introduction, that we call Music and Labor. And I taught a version of that course actually at the University of Massachusetts, UMass as we call it. And that was pre-pandemic. I was scheduled to teach that course in spring 2020. And I, you know, kind of approaching that quarter, I just assumed I would offer pretty much the version of the course that I'd offered at UMass with some slight modifications. You know, UMass is on the semester system. UW is on the quarter system. So that's a complication, right? That's a wrinkle. We have to pare down the syllabus. But then, you know, early March, we go online. It's very quickly apparent that the whole world is changing. We're entering essentially a new historical era, or at least we're coming out of one that's coming to an end. So I, like everyone else, I pivoted at that moment and tried to figure out what I was doing. And I realized it was actually because of the effects of the pandemic on the work that musicians and music teachers do. I realized that it was actually a really important moment to, in a course that's about musical work, that's about music and labor, to try to document what musicians were going through. Obviously, COVID-19, the pandemic has affected virtually everyone in myriad ways, but it's been a very, very difficult time for music and for musicians. I've heard a local labor leader described it to me as a catastrophe for music, right? A lot of people were out of work. It's just a very difficult time for musicians. So one of my goals in that course is always to get students talking to their peers and their mentors about the work that they do, because it's very easy for musicians to, you know, to see what they do, just especially students who are musicians, to see what they do as art, right? First and foremost. And I think that's important, and I don't want to lose sight of that. But a lot of, you know, when you're out in the real world, say as a gigging musician or a music teacher, you do work, and musicians famously are not necessarily particularly well compensated. So I like to get students talking in this course anyway with their peers and their mentors about the work that they do, the conditions of that work, you know, to help them, give them tools for thinking about why musicians aren't compensated better, why conditions aren't better for musicians and music teachers. So we kind of shifted the focus slightly to be on the pandemic, and the students went out and interviewed lots of folks, not just in Seattle, not just in Washington, but actually all around the country, about how the pandemic was affecting their work. And that kind of the interviews went really well. We got some really great material. So I actually started collaborating pretty early on that quarter, spring 2020, with the Labor Archives of Washington, which is part of the University Library. And it's also I think a joint project with the Bridges Center for Labor Studies, which is a really wonderful institution here at the University of Washington. So early on that quarter, we started working very closely with the labor archives to make sure that the interviews wouldn't just kind of end up in a folder on my hard drive and just sit there for eternity until I deleted them, that we could actually deposit them somewhere where people could look at them and hopefully future academics could actually study them as well, but that they could be a resource for musicians looking to organize with one another, looking to, you know, understand the common challenges that a lot of musicians and music teachers face. So we were able to work with the labor archives to preserve those permanently as a record of what it's been like to be a musician, to be a music teacher during the pandemic. So I've learned a lot from watching those interviews and conducting some of the interviews myself, I should say, but learned a lot from those interviews that I don't think I would have learned had the pandemic not occurred when it did. And I was scheduled to teach the course anyway, but I don't think I would have, it just would have been another course at that point, and it wouldn't have developed into something else. So I have absolutely learned a lot. And if anyone's interested, you can go to musicalwork.org, actually, and that will eventually, I think there will be a website there. But for now, it just goes directly to the online archive where the interviews are available for anyone to watch. So I recommend anyone listening to this interview, please go and hear from those musicians and music teachers directly, because I think their stories are really illuminating. They throw a lot of light onto what it's like to be a musician at this particular juncture. And frankly, for many musicians, it's not easy.
Perfect. And we will be sure to put the link to musicalwork.org in the episode description as well. So if you want to just click the link and go there and have a listen to those interviews yourself, you can just go ahead and do that. You mentioned earlier on in the podcast that you were an undecided major yourself during your first few years at UC Berkeley. How did you end up making the decision to study music history, and what was it like to be an undecided major?
Yeah, I had to stop myself from telling this story because I knew you were going to ask this. I had to stop myself from telling this story when you asked me to talk about what music history is, because for me, they're kind of intimately linked with one another. My answers are intimately linked with one another. So yeah, I went to Berkeley. I thought about going lots of places. I went to high school in California, so it was close. And, I love public universities, I always have, and it was close. But I really chose Berkeley because it was one of a small handful of institutions, undergraduate institutions, where it was possible to major both in classics, so Greek and Latin, and astrophysics. And I was dead set on double majoring in classics and astrophysics. I thought I knew for sure what I wanted to do, and I'd taken college courses all throughout high school. So I was ready to hit the ground running in both of these majors as soon as I got to Berkeley. And then I got there and I realized, well, first of all, I was a little bit burnt out, like many people who take a lot of college classes in high school, frankly. I was a little bit burnt out. And I also realized, you know, there might be other things that I could be interested in potentially. And actually, my very first week of classes at Berkeley, I signed up for and stumbled into a course called Baroque Ensemble, which was a musical ensemble, a small orchestra essentially devoted exclusively to performing music from the Baroque period, which, for those who don't know, spans the century and a half or so, from 1600 to 1750. So think Bach and Handel, if you've heard of those composers. Those are both kind of leading Baroque composers. And I'd always loved that repertory with some qualifications. My kind of history with classical music, what we call classical music, is a little bit complicated. And I can say more about that if you're interested. But I stumbled into this class, brought my viola. I was a violist from a pretty young age. And when I got there, I auditioned, got into the ensemble. And what was truly exciting about that group was that we didn't just play on modern instruments, right? So I brought my viola, but when I got there, I was actually handed a modern reproduction of an 18th century viola and got to play that in that group. And the violinists all had actual 18th century violins that had been restored to their original condition. And it was extremely exciting to be playing on these antique instruments. In my case, a modern reproduction, but in an antique style. And also when I was there, I learned that actually there's a whole parallel set of techniques that musicians who specialize in what we call Baroque performance practice have developed for playing music from before 1800. That's pretty frankly, very different from the way that people play Romantic music. So music from after 1800. And different in ways that I found very appealing. It really brought, I'd always liked music from that period, but it really brought it to life for me in a way that, you know, modern performances on modern instruments often don't bring that music to life. They can sound very turgid, very boring, frankly. The music became sexy and I was hooked. I spent a lot of time, I was playing a lot of music at that point. I was in several different rock bands. So I was playing in those groups. And then I was also in this ensemble, spent a lot of time practicing Baroque performance practice. Increasingly kind of ignoring all of my Greek and Latin classes, put off taking the requisite math courses that I needed to continue in astrophysics, didn't take physics, right? So I'm just kind of mostly focusing on music. And it wasn't until kind of halfway through my second year at Berkeley when I realized I'm spending all of my time, not just playing music, but reading about music history, right? I started to get really drawn into reading about the history of music as well, to kind of understand the context for the music I was spending so much time playing. I just realized if this is what I'm spending all my time doing, I should probably make this my major. So it wasn't until halfway through my second year that I made the switch. And it's a kind of intimidating thing to switch into a music major because For those who aren't music majors, you probably don't know, but there are so many prerequisite courses before you can get to the kind of more advanced stuff. There's a lot of basic music theory that you have to complete. And no offense to my colleagues who teach those courses, and I sometimes teach music, kind of introductory music theory courses, or I have in the past. Those courses can be a little bit dry. It can be a little bit boring. Not necessarily my cup of tea. I was kind of more interested in the history, right? So, but I had to complete a lot of prereqs before I got there. It was an intimidating thing. And it meant that, you know, I came in with a lot of credits at Berkeley. I probably could have finished in 2 years if I'd just kind of gone straight onto the track that I'd originally intended. But I took this weird turn into music history. And I think ultimately it was the right turn. I got to pursue something I was really passionate about, really interested in intellectually, artistically. It wasn't easy. It took a lot of work. I was taking like an insane number of credits most of the time I was a music major to catch up. But, you know, in retrospect, I would say it was definitely worth it. And for those of you out there who are kind of dreaming of another major, even after you've declared, if it's still possible to switch and you think you can do it, I say pursue what you're truly interested in, because after college, you can always, you know, go back and retrain for something else. If you decide there's a career, you know, oh, I wish I'd studied nursing. Well, you can go back maybe and be a nursing student, or get, you know, go to coding boot camp if you want to be a software engineer right there, you know. I think of your time as an undergraduate as just an opportunity to explore lots of different areas. And so I love to encourage students to whatever extent they can. And I understand that not everyone feels they have the resources to, you know, explore. And sometimes parents want students to, you know, focus on a particular subject. And I understand all of that, but explore as much as you can. And if you feel like you have no idea what you want to do, and it's already, you know, halfway through your second year, or you're even in your third year or something like that, don't despair. Follow your passions, you know, follow wherever your interests lead you. And I think that's the way to get the most out of your time as an undergraduate.
I completely agree. And this being a podcast focused on helping people decide on potentially what their major could be, I think that's an amazing piece of advice for people who are still soul searching about what they want to do. You mentioned at the beginning of one of your Music History 210 lectures, which I am currently a part of. You should go take the class if you are, even if you aren't a music major, I would highly recommend it. You mentioned that you are a podcast fan. What are your favorite shows to listen to right now? Do you have a favorite?
Yeah, I do have a few favorites. Some of them are pretty nerdy. Some of them are less nerdy. So I very early on in the pandemic, watching my wife was pregnant. And so I was very determined to learn as much about the virus and the disease as I possibly could. So I started listening actually to, I watched lectures in a virology class and then started listening to podcasts by the same professor. He's a professor at Columbia University, fairly well-known virologist named Vincent Racaniello. And he's got this kind of stable of podcasts, the oldest of which is called This Week in Virology. And it's the one that I listen to most actively. So I've learned a lot about virology, as we all have, of course. But I've learned a lot about virology during the pandemic by listening to that podcast and some of their other podcasts as well. It's part of a group called Microbe TV. So I listen to those podcasts. I'm a baseball fan. I've had difficulty following baseball during the pandemic because, frankly, I don't think they should have been playing at all in 2020. And I've still sort of struggled with that in 2021. And Major League Baseball has been giving me all kinds of reasons not to watch. So I haven't really, I've watched a single game this year, but I used to listen very devotedly to Effectively Wild, which is a kind of statistically oriented podcast associated with a website called Fangraphs that some of your listeners may know. So I've listened to that podcast a lot over the years. I'm not exactly a true crime enthusiast, but I do listen to some true crime podcasts. I haven't listened to it in a long time, but I used to listen a lot to one called My Favorite Murder that's very well known. It's a very famous podcast. More recently, I've been very interested in podcasts about Indigenous history. So I listened to one called This Land that I would highly recommend. It's about the first season is about a Supreme Court case from a couple of years ago that essentially reaffirmed that much of Eastern Oklahoma is part of a reservation. And more recently, I've been listening to a couple of podcasts about missing and murdered Indigenous women, which I think is a really important issue, all by a Canadian journalist, investigative journalist, formerly with the CBC named Connie Walker. And the podcast I would really recommend there is called Missing and Murdered, very sensitively done. And because she is a very kind of talented investigative journalist, it's not prurient. It's very respectful, and there's a lot of Indigenous history along the way too. So that's been a difficult but an important learning experience for me listening to those podcasts as well. So yeah, I listen to a lot of podcasts. Haven't yet listened to this one, but I think I just might going forward. I'm sure there are others that I'm forgetting, but that's what's been in the rotation lately.
Great. And we're so glad that you decided to join us on this one today. I just want to say thank you so much for your time. We really appreciate you taking the time out of your day to come talk to us and potentially help people out who are undecided on their major or just want to learn more about music history.
Yeah. And I'm happy to chat with really anyone about music history at any point. It's something that all these years later, I still find endlessly interesting. And we've really barely scratched the surface, I think, of what makes it interesting. But I'm happy to chat with people if that's something that they'd like to consider pursuing. Also, if people are feeling undecided and they want help thinking through their options, maybe I shouldn't do this, but I'm also available for that too. So, people should feel free to reach out to me by email. I'm generally pretty responsive, and I love to hear from students. I love meeting with students. So, hit me up.
Perfect. All right. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of How Do I Get Your Job? I'm Kate Connors, and be sure to follow us wherever you listen to podcasts. We're also on social media at Soundbite and at The Daily on all platforms.